ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What if the most ordinary things in your life aren't ordinary at all? A toothbrush, the pockets in your jeans, even a gravestone. Someone designed them, shaped them, argued over them, and got it so right, you've stopped noticing. The everyday is full of hidden ingenuity, and on By Design with me, Anthony Burke, we pull it all into the light. Search for By Design on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
If a bushfire starts on your property and spreads to your neighbours, are you responsible for their losses? Hi, Damien Carrick here. This is the Law Report on ABC Radio National. That's the question at the centre of a court ruling that found a South Australian pastoralist was responsible for setting fire to a pile of vegetation that was left smouldering and then reignited 6 months later. The South Australian Court of Appeal has upheld an earlier ruling that the late Tom Brinkworth was negligent in starting the blaze that caused about $30 million in damage to his neighbours' properties back in 2021. Michael Eburn is a former associate professor at the Australian National University College of Law, and he's also the author of the Australian Emergency Law blog. Michael, tell me about this fire. How much damage did it cause?
What they'd done was they lit a pile of rubbish in midwinter and thought it would be perfectly safe. 6 months later or so, in January 2021, when it's summer and the weather's very different, it turns out this pile is still glowing hot right in the heart, and it starts a bushfire and escapes. It was a massive fire. I couldn't quantify exactly how much, but the court did talk about the amount of damage done. Here it is: destroyed 14,000 hectares of land, 27 structures, 7,000 livestock and kilometres of fencing. So it was a big fire.
And I think something like 132 property owners were affected. And we're talking about land in the southeast of South Australia, near the town of Lucindale. So this fire, that the damage was caused in January 2021, but the negligence of Tom Brinkworth related to actions 6 months earlier in something like June 2020, when he ignited a vegetation pile. What was this rubbish pile or vegetation pile, and what do we know about vegetation piles at the centre of this court case?
Well, what we know is that burning off rubbish is a pretty standard practice in the agricultural industry. People pile up fallen trees and other material that's got together and set fire to it. But it's a very risky business, and organisations like South Australia's Country Fire Service produce guidelines on how to do it. And the problem was that from the evidence before the court, this fire was not in any way structured in a way recommended by the Country Fire Service. So it had logs in it that were too big. It was too big. And what they didn't do, the negligence and the ongoing negligence, was they didn't keep monitoring it to make sure it was extinguished. Now, you would think if you've lit a fire 6 months ago that it's out, but there's clearly evidence and clearly knowledge and clearly experience that big rubbish piles don't extinguish that quickly. They continue to smoulder deep within them. And so the fire service had recommended things like you turn them over to make sure they're out, you maintain a fire break around them, and those things didn't happen. And that's how, why 6 months later, come the summer weather, it reignited the bush and started the bushfire.
6 months seems a long, long time to somebody who lives in the city for a fire to smoulder. But in fact, it's not that out of the box, is it?
Now, you have to remember, I'm a lawyer and I can talk about the legal issues. I'm not a firefighter and I'm not an expert on fire behaviour. But no, from the evidence and from in the court and from what was written in the CFS guide, no, it's not unusual. People have heard about it. I mean, there's a different context, but there's a fire in Burning Mountain, New South Wales, that's been burning underground for 6,000 years. Now it's burning in a coal seam. The point is, fires can burn hidden for a long time.
And we have guidelines about how to manage these sorts of vegetation pile burns. In this case, through the South Australia Country Fire Service, had these rules, had these guidelines, and the court found that Tom Brinkworth and the people he worked with did not abide by those rules.
They didn't follow it. It wasn't even evidence that they knew of it. They were, as you could imagine, lots of people going, well, I've been doing this for years, I've got lots of experience. But no, they didn't follow the CFS code, and there was no evidence that they even knew about it.
So what was the argument of the Brinkworth family? What did they say? What did they argue about the cause of the fire?
What their argument was that it wasn't the pile that started the fire. They argued that lightning had hit a different tree in November of 2020 and had started a fire in that tree, which no one detected, and it was that tree that caused the fire. But the court reviewed the evidence and found that that explanation for the fire was simply implausible. The evidence just did not support that.
I think the courts, both the Supreme Court judge alone and then the Court of Appeal, looked at all sorts of evidence, including a combination of expert bushfire investigation evidence, physical indicators at the fire ground, aerial imagery and eyewitness testimony in finding the lightning theory didn't fit. I think that the term used was neither probable nor plausible.
And I think that's a really important distinction, because if the fire had been started by lightning and the landowners had no reason to know or suspect that there was burning deep within the roots of a tree, there wouldn't have been any negligence. The problem for them in this case was that if it was the pile burn that started the fire, that was a fire that they lit. And if you light a fire, you are almost, not guaranteed, but almost inevitably liable for it if it escapes. So if you introduce fire to the environment, then you are responsible for ensuring that it doesn't escape. Whereas if nature introduces fire to the environment, it's a different story. So had it been a lightning strike, the outcome could well have been very different.
Michael, there have been other cases where landowners have not been held responsible for fires that started on their property. There was a 2021 New South Wales decision of Woodhouse and I think Fitzgerald and McCoy. What happened in that case and why was the outcome different?
Right, in that case, it was a different sort of fire in that it wasn't a pile burn, but it was a land clearing, burning off the paddock, the grasslands, to get rid of weeds and as a form of hazard reduction, so a slightly different motivation. The defendants in that case got the Rural Fire Service to come and light the fire and monitor it, and the Rural Fire Service did. What happened was that the fire got into the roots of a tree where it smouldered for some time, not 6 months, but I think it was a month or two, and then escaped in similar circumstances. Now, it was found to be no negligence there because they had, in fact, complied with all the things that a reasonable person would do, including inspecting this very tree. So they were well alert to the idea that fires could get into the roots of trees and cause a problem. And they did find another tree that was burning and they knocked it down and filled it with water. But the court said they couldn't go and knock down every single tree. They had to go and inspect them. And they did inspect the tree that ultimately caused the problem. They felt it. They examined it. There was absolutely nothing to suggest that there was a fire burning in the roots of that tree. And all the experts in that case agreed that everything the Rural Fire Service had done was what you would expect them to do. Now, of course, we never get risks to zero. Very low, very unlikely events happened, and this was just an extremely unlikely event that no one could foresee. So when the fire broke out of that one, it was held that there had been no negligence. In this South Australian case, they simply didn't comply with the CFS code. They didn't turn the pile over after they thought it was out to make sure it was out. They didn't have a fire break. So quite different. In Woodhouse case, they did everything they were meant to do, but a very low probability event occurred. In the South Australian case, they just didn't follow the code.
So it's about whether or not you're negligent. There's no kind of strict liability about fire going from one property to another.
There is almost strict liability about fire going from one property to another if you light the fire. And that goes back historically. It was strict liability. If you could prove the fire started on your neighbour's land and it burnt to your property, you were to be held liable. But over time, there became so many workarounds and exceptions to that rule. Then I think it was about 1984, in a case called Burney Port Authority and General Jones, the High Court said, look, we're going to get rid of all these weird, complex rules about fire liability, and it's just negligence. You know, was there a duty of care, and did you take reasonable care? If you're going to light a fire on your property, you're going to always owe a duty to your neighbours because fire is such a high-risk event. And what you're expected to do is take such strong precautions that it's almost strict liability, said the court. Because if you're going to light a fire, you always have the choice to not light it. So you can look around and go, the weather isn't right. I don't have the right firefighting services. For whatever reason, I can choose not to light this fire. So if you're going to choose to light it, you've got to make sure you've got everything in place. Now, in Woodhouse, they had the Rural Fire Service there lighting the fire and monitoring it. And the Rural Fire Service was coming back over the days. So that was a case where they said, all right, you really did do everything right. But it's a tough test. I mean, if you light a fire and it gets away from you, you're almost always going to be liable for the losses.
And in that case, the Woodhouse case, the Rural Fire Service was carrying out the burning on behalf of the landowner. Can firefighters or rural fire services ever be held liable for a fire hazard reduction or burning, even during an emergency?
Generally speaking, no. There's legislation in every piece of fire service legislation that says a fire service won't be liable for acts done in good faith in attempting to perform their act. And that's a different standard to the common law negligence of reasonable care. And it's because they're acting in information poor environments where they've really got to make decisions very quickly. That's when they're fighting a fire. In terms of hazard reduction and setting fires, in the right circumstances, it could be argued. What's interesting in Woodhouse is there was much discussion about whether the Rural Fire Service were negligent, but they were never joined as a party in that case. So they were never brought in, asked to defend their position. And everyone in that case just accepted that they would not be liable by virtue of Section 128 of the New South Wales Rural Fire Service Act. But certainly when it comes to fighting fires, and the fire service will light fires as a firefighting technique, what they call a backburn. There's a difference between a backburn and a hazard control burn. Backburn is where you're lighting a fire in the face of an uncontrolled fire because you want to take the fuel out of it. Sometimes they get away. Sometimes they cause damage and people can show, look, it wasn't the original fire that caused the damage. It was the fire lit by the fire service. But the chances of finding the fire service as liable in those circumstances is almost nil. Now, I'm being a cautious lawyer there and, never say never. But the reality is they're not going to be liable.
Especially in the heat of the moment, in the face of a massive emergency, people are going to be held to a different standard. Because things are so unpredictable, it's very hard to work out what the implications of a particular...
I think as lawyers, what we should say is they're held to the same standard. The standard is, did they do what was reasonable in all the circumstances? But the circumstances might well mean that what is reasonable is different. So to go back to our South Australian case, if you're going to light up a fire to burn a pile of rubbish, the circumstances are such that there's no urgency. You can take all the time you like. You can choose not to do it. You can wait till you've got fire appliances on board. You can have cut your fire breaks. You can make sure the pile's constructed in a particular way. You can take as long as you need. But if you're deciding whether to light a backburn in the face of a bushfire, you're already in terrible fire weather conditions because that's why you're there. So you just don't have those luxuries. And you've got to make a very quick call about, where's this fire going to go? What's going to be damaged? What's the best way to defend it? So it's still what's reasonable in the circumstances, but they're very, very different circumstances.
Michael, if memory serves me correctly, there were legal actions arising out of the 2002-2003 Canberra bushfires, where I think homeowners or perhaps farmers tried to sue firefighters, but these actions failed, didn't they?
Yeah, they all failed. In fact, there have only been five or six cases where people have tried to sue fire services for their response to a fire, as opposed to, preparation things, but in actual response to a fire, they've never been successful.
Michael, does the goal of the farmer or the landowner have any bearing on whether they might be liable in negligence? I think there was a WA case, Boyle. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that was a case where he was burning off wheat stubble, which is a very standard farming practice. He was, in fact, a very experienced bushfire officer himself, but he lit that fire and he was also liable for that. But I think you're right. It does make a difference because modern legislation, the Civil Liability Act in every state and territory, says one of the things to be considered when asking whether the action of a defendant is reasonable is what's the social utility of what they're doing. And certainly in Boyle and Yang, they found that there was no great social utility. He was doing it for his own private economic interests. In the South Australian case we've just mentioned, again, just burning off a rubbish pile is just, you're acting in your own interest. Whereas in that Woodhouse case, one of these motivations was a hazard reduction to try and reduce the risk of future bushfires. There's another really interesting case from Western Australia which involved damage to grapes.
Smoke damage to grapes, right?
Smoke damage. Yeah. So the Department of Environment and Conservation was doing a hazard reduction burn. So they were doing it because it was government policy. And, you know, every time we have bushfires, people talk about government land and whether it's been properly managed. And it was government policy to do hazard reductions. And there's always very limited times when you can do these. Because back to that earlier point, if you're going to light a fire, you've always got the option to not light it. So they really had to wait for the weather was perfect and the right circumstances. And this was a area of land they'd wanted to burn off, and it was to protect community assets, not their own assets, you know, reduce the risk of fire affecting them. So they decided this was the only time they could do it, and they even took into account the risk of smoke affecting grapes and hoped the wind would go the right way. They lit the fire, of course things didn't quite go to plan, and the smoke hit the grapes. And in the Court of Appeal there, the majority very much focused on the social utility of what they were doing. They had to implement government policy. And interestingly enough, in that one, they said, yeah, and you can't control the smoke. Whereas if it's a fire, in theory, you can. If you're going to light a fire, in theory, you can control it because you build your fire breaks and you have fire appliances and firefighters there and you can put the fire out. But once you've got a fire going, the smoke will go where it will go. And the wind did not quite behave as predicted, so it impacted this grape crop.
I understand in that case, the winery or the grape growers even asked, said, please don't do it now. But the Conservation and Land Management Authority said, no, we have to.
That's right. This is the only window we've got. And the weather forecast is the best it's going to be, both for the fire and for hopefully not directing the smoke over your grapes. I mean, it's a real tragedy of that case, because if they were really burning for community benefit, to protect the community, then it was the plaintiffs who lost their grapes who had to pay the cost of the community benefit. I think there's an argument to say, if you're doing something for the benefit of the community, an individual suffers a clearly identifiable loss, that maybe we should compensate that individual for the loss they paid for a community benefit. But that's not what happened.
You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National. Today we're looking at who can be held legally liable for bushfire damage. I'm speaking with emergency law expert Michael Eburn. Michael, are power companies ever held liable for bushfires that start in power lines?
A fascinating question, because they get sued all the time. And we certainly traced them back to being sued. The first ones we found in some research we did a few years ago now was back in 1977. Grass fires in Victoria, the electricity companies were sued. Then 1983 in Ash Wednesday, and certainly in Black Saturday, large number of claims against the power lines. They nearly all settle. And there are many reasons why defendants settle cases, but it means, in fact, there's been no judicial ruling. I'm aware of one judicial ruling where a power company has been found liable for its assets causing a fire. So yes, they're sued, but they settle out of court. And so we don't get a ruling that they were negligent or not. And there are lots of reasons why they'd settle without ever admitting liability, and they never admit they're negligent. And so it's a really interesting case. The one where they were liable was in Western Australia. They were running a power line to a private power pole. The private power pole was dangerously defective. The electricity company's line was, it wasn't our pole, we weren't responsible for it, but the answer was, well, you're running electricity to it and you have all sorts of responsibilities to ensure the safety of the system, and you had the power to tell the pole owner, if you don't fix it, we're disconnecting your electricity, and they didn't. So in that one, they were found liable. That's the first and only one where I've seen a judge say an electricity authority is liable for a fire that their assets have caused, because there's always a dispute about, was that the cause of the fire? And then were they negligent? Because they've got to run power lines. We all want power.
And they had to have responsibility for those power connections. I understand there is a class action in South Australia right now where bushfire victims from the 2019 Cuddly Creek bushfire are seeking compensation from South Australia Power Networks, alleging that the energy distributor was negligent in the lead up to the blaze. I think the fire started after a falling tree dislodged a power line, and I think there's something like 2,000 affected properties and 3,000 individuals. So these cases are ongoing.
And no doubt, and certainly the ABC is reporting that the defendant is saying they weren't negligent. And you might say, well, this power line was exposed to a particular dangerous tree, but the electricity authority's got to say, well, we're actually responsible for the whole network, and we've got to look at and assess risk, and maybe Yes, there was something we could have done there, but maybe somewhere else was a higher priority and we were diverting our resources to that because we only have a certain number of resources. So there'll be a huge argument about whether or not there was actual negligence. Merely proving that the downed power line caused the fire doesn't prove negligence.
But Michael, what about fires in city buildings? Are firefighters ever sued for what they did do or didn't do in the context of a building fire?
They've been sued, I'm aware of two, what we would call urban fire litigation. One was in Queensland, the judgment was in 2014, not the fire. Another one was in Tasmania, again, the judgment in 2012. But again, been found not liable. And the argument, well, there are two arguments. One is that, as I say, every fire service legislation has protection for them. It says you're not liable for acts done in good faith in the performance of their duties, and that's been relied on. That was certainly relied on in the Tasmanian case because the court dealt with that separately. They said, assuming the fire service was negligent, would this section protect them? Yes, it would. We don't therefore need to consider whether they were negligent or not. Whether they were negligent or not, they're not going to be liable. They're not liable. But anyway, so there was that case in Hobart when the Meyer store burnt down and the fire service had turned off the water that was operating the sprinklers, and that allowed the fire to escape. And they did that because there was live electricity to the building and they didn't want to go wandering, sending firefighters into a building that had water streaming from the roof through electrical wires. You know, it's just too risky. So they had to turn the water off. And for various reasons, that was a much more practical solution than trying to turn the power off. And in Queensland, the Queensland case, it was a factory fire and the fire service, it was a huge fire. And they were pouring water into this factory because that's, you know, really the only tool they had. And as a result, they were washing all these chemicals into the nearby river. And the property owner ended up liable for the cost of cleaning up the river. And his argument was, well, if you hadn't shown up, all those pollutants would have gone up in smoke. And I would not have been liable for the cost of the cleanup because there wouldn't have been a cost. But the court just said, the fire service aren't there as your agent. They're not there to do what you want. They were there to protect the community and the best way to do it and the judgment they had to make was to try and put the fire out. And they did. And they prevented further explosions, but it cost this fellow money. But again, they were not liable for that. The fire services aren't actually there for the benefit of the person whose property is on fire. They're there for the benefit of the community and to stop fires spreading. Now, the obvious and usual way to stop a fire spreading is to put it out where it is, but they don't have to. So the fire service might turn up and go, well, your property's a total loss. We're going to spend our time defending the properties next door. Or your property's in the path of a fire, but we want to protect the local village where there are more people. Or we're going to protect a factory or a bit of industry that employs lots of people. And if it burns down, that's going to have a much bigger economic impact than if your farm goes.
Michael, you live on the south coast of New South Wales, a very fire-prone area. How are issues around fire hazard reduction handled? And how front of mind are they in your community?
Well, look, I was not here during the 2019-2020 Black Summer fires. But when I talk to people who were, it's absolutely front and centre of people's minds. My local community has a progress association that is constantly lobbying our council about hazard reduction. And so it's absolutely front and centre. And in light of what we were talking about in that South Australian case, if I drive around here, there are roadside electric signs constantly reminding if I want to light a pile burn, I have to notify the Rural Fire Service. And so that's in your face as you're driving around. If you're going to light a fire, including a pile burn, you have to contact the RFS and talk to them about it before you do it.
And get their approval?
Yes, and get a permit. Yep. It's absolutely front and centre.
Now, Michael, this is 100% not legal advice for listeners, but theoretically, in terms of avoiding a legal suit from your neighbours, as a landowner, are you better off reducing fire hazards and potentially causing a fire which escapes, or ignoring a fire hazard, which ultimately does lead to a fire that you have no hand in lighting, which does damage your property and the property of your neighbours. Legally speaking, what's the better strategy?
Legally speaking, and this is an article that I wrote with a colleague from the ANU in the International Journal of Wildland Fire, we looked at this. because there's a sort of adage in the fire industry that if you own the fuel, you own the fire. And the argument is if you've got hazardous material on your property and a fire starts by whatever means, power lines fall, lightning, whatever it is, and your fuel carries the fire to your neighbor, you are responsible for that fire. And we looked at the law and we could find no legal principle that supports that. We could find no one who had been sued successfully because they hadn't done hazard mitigation and a naturally occurring fire spread across their property. What we found every time was that people were liable for fires that they lit, where they were the cause of the ignition. So our argument was, if you're toying with the idea of doing hazard reduction by lighting a fire, there are other ways to do hazard reduction, but if you're talking about a hazard reduction fire, if you light that fire and it escapes, you will almost inevitably be liable for the damage. If you do nothing and the fire starts and escapes, you won't be. So legally, the risk is probably in favor of doing nothing. Now, the problem with that is that's quite inconsistent with community interest and effective policy that says we want people to be doing hazard reductions and we want people to reduce the hazard on their land for the benefit of their neighbors. But legally, as the law currently stands, if you light a hazard reduction fire and it gets away from you, you will probably be liable. We can look at Woodhouse case. They weren't. So, you know, I can only say probably, not inevitably. You'll probably be liable. If you do nothing and a fire starts and burns through your property, then you probably won't be liable. There was an English case. It was called Stoven and Wise. Nothing to do with a bushfire. It was an urban fire. And it started in premises that were just a mess, loads of old tires and things. And the fire was innocently started. So it was nobody's fault that the fire started. But the amount of disorganized potential fuel that burnt carried the fire to the neighbor. And at the end of the decision, the judge said, the lesson from all this is make sure you're insured, because that the people who owned the shop that burnt were not liable for the spread of the fire. They didn't start the fire. They weren't therefore liable for its spread, even though it was their fuel that carried it.
Do you think that there is the right alignment between our laws around liability and policies which minimise the possible damage caused by a fire? Do you think we have the right balance?
Well, in the paper that Associate Professor Carey and I wrote, we argued that it would be better if you're going to do a hazard reduction burn and you get a permit from the Rural Fire Service that sets out, and we were particularly focused on New South Wales, and sets out, you know, what you have to do and what sort of assets you have to do, and you comply with it, we thought that should be a defence. Currently, I suppose it would be evidence that you acted reasonably. We thought that should be strengthened statutorily. So I guess my answer is no, I don't think we do. I think the law encourages people to do nothing when that is not what we want them to do.
And how could we recalibrate? How could we rebalance?
Well, as I say, you would provide that it was a defence to a claim if you had obtained a permit from the Rural Fire Service and it complied with all its terms and conditions. So, you know, to go back to the South Australian case, if they'd actually got a permit from the CFS and they'd said you had to comply with the pile code, and they had. But equally, if they'd complied with the pile code in that case, the fire would never have happened.
Michael Eburn, a former associate professor at ANU and author of the Australian Emergency Law blog, thank you for speaking to the Law Report.
Been my pleasure.
That's all we've got time for. Do follow the Law Report on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. A big thank you to producer Christina Cucoglia and audio producer this week, Carey Dell. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.